Hello, welcome to Health Chat. I am Chinedu Ofor for Leonard Modu. Today, a discussion about a deadly hemorrhagic infection, Marburg virus disease, and other health stories from around the world. The World Health Organization is investigating an outbreak of the Marburg infections in Equatorial Guinea. The agency assesses that the risk posed by the outbreak is high at the national level, moderate at the regional level, and low at the global level. This is the first outbreak of Marburg, a hemorrhagic virus reported in Equatorial Guinea. There are fears that if unchecked, the virus may spread to countries with larger population close to the country, like Nigeria and Cameroon. Joining me for a discussion on this highly infectious disease is a public health expert, Dr. Edward Ihejirika.
Marburg is a viral disease. It's actually a highly contagious, fatal and infectious disease, and it's caused by the Marburg virus. The thing is, the host is the bat, something called the African fruit bat. Most people who get in contact with this bat, especially minors, they contact the Marburg virus. The Marburg virus disease has actually been detected in Africa, even though it was first found out in Germany after a green monkey was sent to a lab in Germany. Recently, in 2021, in Guinea, it was detected. And in 2022, in Ghana, it was also detected. Recently, in Equatorial Guinea, Marburg virus disease was also detected. Nigeria happens to have the Centers for Disease Control, which normally initiate protocols for handling these kinds of viral diseases.
You mentioned that Nigeria has the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. From what you know, and knowing that Nigeria, according to statistics, is almost, when it comes to population, is the most populous nation in Africa. People move from the borders and in and outside of Nigeria. Do you think Nigeria has the capacity? Do you think Nigeria has what it takes, not just surveillance, but to deal with such an infectious disease like the Marburg virus?
I would say that Nigeria has actually improved over the last decade. And I would say that the NCDC, they have the capacity to test for the Marburg virus disease at the National Research Laboratory here in Abuja. They also have the human resource, that is technical capacity, and also for the lab for the prompt identification and management in the event of an importation, for example, from, you know, Equatorial Guinea. So I would say they have the capacity to handle an outbreak of a Marburg virus disease.
How does the Marburg virus, Marburg infection, how does it present? What are the symptoms?
The Marburg virus disease is typically known as a viral hemorrhagic fever. Essentially, it starts with a fever, a headache, general feeling of unwell. You could have body pains, just aches. These are very almost non-specific symptoms, but this could mimic malaria, for example. But typically what happens is that a progression of this illness, say in about 7 to 8 days, you could have significant internal bleeding and eventually organ failure if it's not identified or detected and treated. So presentation is almost like what you would know in the past, Ebola. It has a similar presentation like Ebola, but it is not as virulent as Ebola. Typically fever, headaches, feeling of unwell, body aches, body pain, could lead to several bleeding from the mouth, from the nose, from the orifices, as it were. That's the presentation.
Dr. Hejirika, you talked about the presentation of this disease, and you said it's very virulent. You also talked that the possibility of spreading is quite high. So in a country like Nigeria, in a country like Equatorial Guinea, in a country like Ghana, where, of course, the custom is for people to get together, it's for people to hug each other, for people to visit, what is the possibility or probability that if it comes into a country like Nigeria, just might have an outbreak that beyond what a lot of medical experts can handle?
Well, you know, because it's not a very typical, if the Marburg viral disease manages to escape the protocols of the Nigerian health authorities at the airport, you know, escape all those surveillance that have been put in place and get into the country, you want to avoid contact with blood, saliva, and body fluids of suspected cases. Illnesses that have not been properly diagnosed, you want to avoid individuals who are probably coming in from overseas with known illnesses. You want to avoid contact with their blood, their saliva, and body fluids generally. You also want to avoid, as you know, culturally or customarily, Africans or Nigerians like to indulge in eating wild animals like bushmeats, as it were. And so you want to avoid handling bushmeat also, because since the bat, the African bat, is the natural host, it is believed that contact with this bat and even other wild animals could be a potential route of transmission. So you want to avoid anything to do with wild animals and contact with blood and saliva, because getting in contact with any of this could pass through the mucous membranes of an individual, and basically the person becomes completely affected.
You talked about the local delicacy of bats and bush meat that people consume, and of course, that might be a route through which they can catch Marburg fever. Now, can you tell us if Marburg fever or the bat, is it a bat-to-person transmission? Or if the bat, for instance, bites an animal that becomes a bush meat, is there a possibility that anyone who consumes that meat might catch this virus?
Yes, there's a possibility. Even though it's still not very clear, but we think that the African bat has been identified mostly because of mine workers who are exposed to these bats. And it's believed that the African bat, when it gets in contact with other animals, for example, bat bite, right, it's possible that they become another route of transmission also. This is exactly how, and it's transmitted from man to man. When somebody gets in contact with a bat and gets affected by this virus disease, any contact with another man or another individual who has cuts can get affected, particularly when it's in contact with the blood or the saliva, any of the body fluids of the suspected case, easily transmit from one individual to another. So that's the route of transmission. It's man to man.
What are the management protocols for Marburg fever, Marburg virus, or Marburg infection?
Right, so what is very critical here is that early diagnosis, identification of possible Marburg virus is very, very critical in actually arresting this situation. And even though there is no specific treatment for Marburg virus disease, what you want to do is provide supportive and palliative treatment to symptoms that are presented by suspected case. And so taking care of supportive or palliative treatment, you want to make sure that the patient has adequate fluid. You have to monitor the electrolytes of this patient. You also have to ensure that they have good oxygen status, monitor their blood pressure. And in cases where there's bleeding from the orifices, you might want to give blood transfusion. So you actually just treat the complications as they arise. You know, some may have severe headache, high-grade fever, just feeling unwell, and probably even affect making urine, all right? So you want to treat as the complications arise. But there's no known specific treatment for Marburg virus disease. This has to be very clear. And, of course, suspected case, you have to go to the lab to carry out testing. And common testings are using the polymerase chain reaction, the ELISA test. These are the tests that are carried out in the lab to diagnose Marburg virus disease. But it's important to say that an early diagnosis based on clinical acumen, clinical suspicion of the presentation, the presenting symptoms of the patient, can lead you to an early diagnosis, because an early diagnosis is ultimately what saves the life of an individual who's exposed to this virus. Because indeed, the case fatality rate of the Marburg virus is so high. The case fatality rate being the ability of this illness to lead to death in an individual is usually up to 90%. Usually between 23 to 90%. So that's why it's highly contagious. It's a fatal disease, basically. Early diagnosis and supportive treatment helps to restore individuals back to health.
As a medical practitioner, what advice as a public health expert would you give to anyone listening to us, or would you give to the public, on how to stay safe from this virus that you said has almost a 90 or 90-something percent fatality rate?
One among many pieces of advice would be to avoid travel to the areas where the outbreak is reported. For example, Equatorial Guinea a couple of weeks ago said to have an outbreak. So you want to advise people not to travel for business, for leisure, anything. And then you want to avoid contact with suspects or even people who have been confirmed to have Marburg virus disease. You want to avoid contact with such people, right? And even people who have symptoms that have been described earlier on seem to look like this, you should also avoid them. You have to isolate such persons. And when you isolate them, you ensure that the healthcare workers who go to take care of them actually are very well kitted, you know, with what we call the personal protective equipment, using gloves. And then you want to safely dispose the bed sheets and all the materials that are around these patients, because contamination of these materials, when they get in contact with a healthcare worker, for example, he can also get contaminated. So we're scared for the patient. We're also scared for the health worker who's looking after the patient. So this brings me to a practice of infection prevention and control in healthcare settings. These are the things that will help to prevent transmission of the Marburg viral disease. It's also important to educate the public a lot about this to avoid things like bushmeat, which is a delicacy. And then the government also has to improve on its infrastructure, you know, public health infrastructure in handling some of these infectious diseases, which over the last decade the government has been doing. But also the subnationals, that's the state governments, also have to improve their synergy between the federal government, National Centers for Disease Control, and the state governments, because early diagnosis and being ready can help, you know, a better coordination of when an outbreak takes place in a timely manner and also in a way that is efficient. Also, disease surveillance, right? You have to be able to survey, you know, keep in touch through your disease surveillance officers who monitor and track risks in communities where there could be a possible outbreak. For example, in neighboring communities between Nigeria and Equatorial Guinea. Equatorial Guinea is just about 130 kilometers to Calabar. And Cameroon is also next to Equatorial Guinea. You want to survey, you want to put a surveillance officer or surveillance desk in these areas that are border to Nigeria to ensure that we understand the behavior of illnesses that have come up in those communities. And then, of course, you can't rule out training. You have to keep training and retraining healthcare workers. You know, you have to let them understand that a lot of misconceptions around the Marburg virus disease are common. So when you train them, they're able to identify these illnesses even before the very well-trained medical officer from a hospital is informed. You know, I would say enlightenment campaigns are also very important. Massive enlightenment campaigns should be carried out, letting people know that this is a very deadly illness, and anyone who comes down with it, the chances are that the person isn't going to make it. We have to train people in the front lines, you know, around areas where they could be susceptible to the Marburg virus disease.
That's a public health expert, Dr. Edward Ihejirike, speaking with me from Abuja. Equatorial Guinea has confirmed its first ever Marburg virus outbreak this month. According to the World Health Organization, at least 9 deaths and 16 suspected cases have been reported in the Central African country. The viral hemorrhagic fever has a fatality rate of up to 88%. Emmanuel Baron, Director of Medicine Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders, spoke to Ricky Stryak about this outbreak and the history of the disease in the region.
What we see in this current outbreak, with around probably 25 to 30 suspected cases and so far a bit more than 10 deaths, is that it looks a bit like what we see in similar, what we saw in similar situations in the past, in Angola, in DRC, in Kenya, or even more recently in Guinea, Conakry, or in Ghana. Even in those two settings, there were far less cases. The disease remains the same with the general sign that we know and the hemorrhagic aspect of the disease is there. There is a need definitely for coordinated response with the government, and WHO is also in support of this response today in order to cut the transmission and treat cases.
Is there a history of outbreaks in this particular region, in this particular area? Are there is there the infrastructure in place to try to cut the transmission as quickly as possible?
Absolutely, no. There's no experience of such outbreaks in Equatorial Guinea. It's true that in the past that were more in Central Africa, but we saw, as I mentioned earlier, some cases in Guinea-Conakry and Ghana. That was the first time in West Africa we saw Marburg cases. You may remember that we saw Ebola cases in the past in West Africa with a massive outbreak 2014-2015. And therefore, when there is an emerging disease in a new area, this is very challenging for the government and for all the population. However, there are some classical ways to respond to this outbreak, with being able to contact of cases, being able to isolate those cases and to cause the transmission. But it's definitely a big challenge for health structures, for the medical authorities and the authorities in general. This is also complicated because those diseases are frightening. You know that the proportion of death among the cases is high, probably above 50% in general in such outbreaks, and it's extremely frightening for the population. We saw in situations I mentioned earlier in the other countries that this works, and there are some possibilities to contain the spread of the disease among the population.
WHO is anticipating vaccine trial in Equatorial Guinea. What kind of developments are we up to at this point in terms of vaccines for Marburg, and what work still needs to be done?
Well, this is a very tricky question, because it's true that there are some candidate vaccines, as we say. There are some institutions that have developed vaccines so far. However, those vaccines against Marburg were never tested in the general population in the context of an outbreak. Two of them only were tested among volunteers, healthy volunteers. So we are at very early stages of the development of new vaccines, and definitely outbreak is a perfect situation, if I may say so, to test those new vaccines. However, the challenge is that there are very few cases in general, and the outbreak is contained by the authorities. So with a very short period of time, it's extremely difficult to mount a trial to assess the efficacy of those new vaccines. So this is always the challenge, being able to test the vaccine in difficult situations and at the same time to try to decrease the period during which you try this vaccine. So these vaccines are very early stages of their development, and so far there is none of them which is indicated to be part of the response. WHO organized a meeting earlier this month in order to assess where the development of those vaccines were, and there are certainly some hopes that one of them is going to be used in the context of this outbreak of the future one, but for Marburg so far we have not tested anything.
Are there concerns about the fear of the spread into the neighboring countries?
There is always this fear that the virus will cross the borders, because virus ignore borders by definition, I would say. In this case, the risk is estimated to be quite low. Because of the previous experience, and we saw with Ebola, for example, in 2014-15, that if there were some cases in neighboring countries, there were some also reactions, such as in Mali or in Senegal, where actually the response did not allow the virus to create a large epidemic in those countries. So there is definitely a need for surveillance, for transparency of information, clarity of information of what's going on, and a coordination between countries to organize that properly. If it's done well, there's no reason actually that the disease creates the same situation that the COVID-19 did, because the disease is transmitted with direct contact, infected surfaces of with patients, and you tend to be able to better identify the cases, so you can react very quickly in order to isolate a patient. But we need to be careful. It's extremely difficult to predict for sure what's going to happen, but if we take the good decision, we make the good decisions, and coordination between countries is well done, then there is very little chance that this will create a massive outbreak in the coming future.
That's Emmanuel Baron, Director of Medicine Sans Frontières Epicenter. He was speaking to Ricky Shryock from Paris. You are listening to Health Chat on Voice of America. It is time for a short break. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
We are bringing women voices to the conversation on things that matter to the hearts and minds of women. From right here in the nation's capital to on the ground from all over the African continent. We hear your voices. Our voices. Right here on VOA on Wednesdays at 1900 UTC.
Welcome back to Health Chat. I am Chinedu Ofor in for Leonard Modu. A report by four top UN agencies and the World Bank estimate that every 2 minutes, one woman dies during pregnancy or childbirth, most from preventable causes. Lister Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The agencies say the alarming data they have collected should be a wake-up call for world leaders to take action to end the inadequate health care and widening social and economic inequities behind these unacceptable deaths. They say pregnancy and childbirth should be a time of joy. It should not be a death sentence. The report tracks maternal deaths between 2000 to 2020. It finds an estimated 287,000 women around the world died from a maternal cause in 2020. That is equivalent to 800 deaths a day, or one death every 2 minutes. Jenny Creswell is a scientist and epidemiologist at WHO and author of the report. She says nearly all these maternal deaths are due to preventable causes.
Maternal mortality is an outcome for which globally we see very substantial inequities, so between richer countries and poorer countries and for subgroups within countries, depending on characteristics and access to care. This raises important concerns around access to high-quality, respectful care and sexual and reproductive rights and women's autonomy.
The report says some significant progress in reducing maternal deaths was made between 2000 and 2015. However, it notes this is largely stalled and in some cases been reversed. For example, between 2016 and 2020, data show two regions, Australia and New Zealand, and Central and Southern Asia, reduced maternal deaths significantly. The picture is quite different in sub-Saharan Africa, which has the highest rate of maternal mortality, accounting for 70% of maternal deaths worldwide. WHO Assistant Director General for Universal Health Coverage, Anshu Banerjee, says for every woman that dies, 15 to 30 women suffer disability related to complications caused by pregnancy and childbirth.
Nearly half of all pregnancies are unintended, which is highlighting the lack of access of some 270 million women globally to modern family planning methods, meaning they are unable to choose how and when to plan their families. Many lack access to safe abortion, which increases risk of complications, including deaths associated with unsafe procedures.
The leading causes of maternal deaths include severe bleeding, high blood pressure, pregnancy-related infections, complications from unsafe abortion, and underlying conditions such as HIV/AIDS and malaria. UN health officials say these conditions are largely preventable and treatable for women who have access to high-quality and respectful health care. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Ghana Health Service says a shortage of routine vaccines for children blamed for a measles outbreak that infected 120 will be resolved within weeks. Health officials say the shortage of vaccines against polio, hepatitis B, and measles was caused by the depreciation of Ghana's currency, the cedi. The Pediatric Society of Ghana warned childhood diseases could spread quickly if the vaccines were not soon made available. Kent Mensah reports from Accra, Ghana.
For months, nursing mothers have been complaining of shortage of vaccines meant for babies from birth to at least 18 months. The situation became worse in February after major health facilities in 10 out of the 16 administrative regions of Ghana kept turning nursing mothers away due to erratic supply. Vivian Helemi said her baby girl missed one of the key vaccinations last month, and the situation has not changed after combing three health centers on Monday. Like other mothers, Helemi is worried the shortage of the essential vaccine for infants will pose a threat to her child. It has been frustrating moving from one hospital to another, she told VOA. She added, I don't know what will happen to my baby because she's yet to receive a second vaccination. I am confused because no one is telling me when the vaccines will be ready. Timely vaccination of children, according to UNICEF, is a proven method for saving lives from vaccine-preventable diseases. It can also help attain some targets like the UN Sustainable Development Goal 3, which aims to ensure healthy lives and promote well-being for all. UNICEF's Ghana office says on its website that the country has seen a significant fall in deaths from vaccine-preventable diseases. For example, since 2003, there has been no deaths caused by measles, while in 2011, Ghana was certified as having attained elimination status for maternal and neonatal tetanus. Dr. Ejewa Boniedie, a member of the Pediatric Society of Ghana, said the government must act now in order not to erode the gains made so far.
This is the first time I'm hearing of such widespread shortages. So we do have shortages from time to time. However, those are in very limited circumstances. The problem this time is that it has gone over for several months. This should actually be a thing of the past. governments should be encouraged to do what we call ring-fence funding, such that budgetary allocations for vaccines are actually protected, no matter what other dire or pressing needs that the country has. The children should be secured in that light.
The Director General of the Ghana Health Service, Dr. Patrick Omabuaji, said the situation would change by the end of March.
We have had some delays in procuring some of those vaccines, but which polio, MR, and the BCG are in short supply. Just also because the ministry's budget to procure them are in cities, and at the time that was due for procurement, because of the exchange difference, it was very difficult to procure. So now we've done it, and we hope that within the next 2-3 weeks we'll address it.
Parliament has summoned the West African country's health minister, Kwaku Ajimamenu, to discuss the vaccine shortage. The next few days are crucial for many children, especially those who live in inner cities and dense parts of urban areas and are exposed to vaccine-preventable diseases at an early age. Kent Mensah for VOA News, Accra, Ghana.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis, inviting you to listen every week as a panel of VOA and Washington-based journalists discuss the top domestic and international news stories. With our correspondents and sources from the White House, Capitol Hill, and elsewhere, we will bring you the inside stories from Washington. That's Issues in the News every week on The Voice of America.
A top WHO official calls the recent global spread of bird flu and human infections worrying. Dr. Sylvie Bryant spoke Friday after health authorities in Cambodia said the father of an 11-year-old girl who died this week after contracting bird flu has also tested positive to the virus. The girl from a village in southeastern Cambodia died Wednesday shortly after tests confirmed she had bird flu. Bird flu, also known as avian influenza, normally spreads between sick poultry, but can sometimes spread from poultry to humans. The recent detection of infections in a variety of mammals has raised concern that the virus could evolve to spread more easily between people, but they say the risks are currently small. Two experts appointed by the WHO to investigate allegations that some of his staffers sexually abused women during an Ebola outbreak in Congo have dismissed the UN agency's handling of the probe. Some of the victimized women say nearly 4 years later they are still waiting for the WHO to fire those responsible or be offered financial compensation. The two experts also slammed the WHO for its failure to punish any senior staffers linked to the abuse, saying there is a, quote, culture of impunity, unquote. The WHO says it has, quote, zero tolerance, unquote, for misconduct and has created a new department to prevent sexual abuse and exploitation. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has approved the first combination test for flu and COVID-19 that can be used at home, giving consumers an easy way to determine if a runny nose is caused by either disease. The Lucira COVID-19 and flu home tests, which can be purchased without a prescription, uses self-collected nasal swab samples and delivers results in about 30 minutes. While at-home COVID tests are readily available, this is the first home test for influenza A and B, commonly known as the flu. The test was granted an emergency use authorization, which facilitates the availability of, quote, medical countermeasures, unquote, during public health emergencies. Macau, the world's biggest gambling hub, has eased its requirements for people to wear masks after mandating them for most of the COVID-19 pandemic. Starting Monday, people no longer have to wear masks when outdoors, the statement by authorities in Chinese territory said. They will still be required in places like elderly care homes and hospitals and on public transit, but indoor venues such as casinos have the discretion to decide themselves whether to require masks. The statement said the policy was eased because the virus situation in Macau, quote, has continuously remained stable for the past 2 months, unquote. In neighboring Hong Kong, authorities last week extended its mandate until March 8th to reduce the spread of respiratory viruses in cold weather, although they have signaled they may ease the requirements soon. Violators of the mandate requiring masks to be worn indoor and outdoor public areas can be fined HK$5,000, which is about $637 on the spot. That's all for this edition of Health Chat. For more health news and medical breakthroughs, visit voaafrica.com. Thank you all for joining us, and special thanks to all our affiliate stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat. I'm your host, Chinedu Afua, in for Linon Modu in Washington. Until next time, take care, stay safe, and strive to make every day a healthy day.